When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
So, Pete, can you recall what it feels like to be in a budding or new romance?
I mean, to a certain extent, but it's funny because whenever you think back to times like that, you know, it's always like your memory is a little bit different than what actually happened. You know, it's actually kind of intoxicating, isn't it?
It really is. It really is. And we're both married and we've been married for a while, right? I'm assuming you've been with your partner for some time.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's kind of hard to remember that far back. But I do remember dating my husband and like the butterflies and the flirtation and the giddiness, as you're saying, like you're just like you're intoxicated, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it's a sweet feeling, and I love this episode because we get to really see that play out, especially with Jesse and Jane, and it's this very sweet young couple romance that we get to watch unfold. And then we also get to see a budding romance happen at Beneke Fabricators, don't we?
I guess we do, don't we?
Yeah, so one is a more innocent, you know, young love kind of relationship, and one is rather scandalous, isn't it?
Yeah, definitely. We were talking a little bit before we started, and I find it really hard to remember how this played out. I mean, how I interpreted this when I first saw it. Like I think you see clearly that you understand why she went there because of the money, you know, because of what happened. But it's pretty right there in your face when you know what to look for. So yeah, it'll be interesting to talk about that and what's actually going on there.
So worth mentioning that this isn't actually the first time we see Beneke. It's the first time we meet the character, but the first time we actually see him is in a photograph that she sees in, I think it was in Down, the episode Down, as she's sitting in the nursery going through a stack of photos and mm-hmm. she's looking at this photo of her and Beneke. So that seed was kind of already planted, right? And yeah, we'll definitely get more into this as we start talking about the episode.
You did not kill anyone. Does anybody think that you killed anybody?
I called the cops.
You called the cops?
Yeah. You know, I called and I split, you know, then they came in and busted her. Gosh, she was so zapped out of her mind. You know, it's... She did it for, like, nothing. I mean, he told her she was a skank, but, yo, I mean, she was a skank.
This is Growth, Decay, Transformation, a Breaking Bad rewatch podcast. I'm Courtney.
And I'm Pete.
And today we're going to be talking about Season 2, Episode 7, Negro y Azul, or Black and Blue. So, Pete, you want to give us a synopsis of what happens in this one?
Yeah, it was one of those episodes where everybody's off doing their own thing, and they just sort of come together at different points. In the beginning, Walt isn't able to get a hold of Jesse on the phone. He's not answering, so he's forced to go over to his apartment. And in the process of banging on his door, he meets his landlord, Jane. Of course, she won't open the door for him, even after he says he's Jesse's father. But eventually, Jesse does come out and lets him in. And he tells him about what happened at Spooge's. Jesse's obviously traumatized from this. Walt isn't really that concerned about that part of it. He's worried more about what, you know, how this might get, if it might get back to the police, or if this might cause problems for their operation. But what happens is that Jesse basically is just sitting around smoking weed, trying to forget. And that means that Walt has to go meet and do the meet with Skinny Pete, Badger, and Combo. While they're talking, they ask if Jesse really crushed Spooge's head with an ATM machine. And that this lets him know that the story's out there on the street and it's making an impression on people. Walt knows that the version of the story that they've heard, the one that they're telling him, isn't true, but he decides not to tell them. He actually lets them believe it, and then he gets an idea. So he goes back and he tells Jesse they need to expand their operation. He thinks it's the right time, which it definitely is not, if you think about what we've seen in the last couple of episodes. This is a terrible idea. And Jesse tries to explain that, you know, that these other crews wouldn't just let them come and sell in their neighborhoods. It's pretty basic stuff, you know, that I'm not even sure if we're supposed to understand that, you know, maybe Walt didn't think about it, or if it's just that he just doesn't care. Like, he's in desperation mode. And, you know, we'll get into that in a bit. But, you know, eventually he talks him into it. And by basically saying, you know what? They can use this idea that Jesse's a killer to intimidate their competition. And, you know, he uses this blowfish speech, which I'm sure we're going to talk a lot about. And, you know, Jesse buys into it by the end. So elsewhere, we have Hank. He started his job down in El Paso. He transferred to that office. And it's clear right from the very beginning that he doesn't fit in with the agents there.
That scene is so awkward.
Yeah.
I love the way Dee Norris plays it. It's great.
Yeah, one of my favorite things about this episode is that they have them speaking in Spanish and they don't put subtitles.
Mm-hmm.
To show us how out of the loop that, you know, like they're definitely making him feel like he doesn't belong, as well as it being obvious, you know what I mean? And I like that mm-hmm. little detail of how, you know, generally whenever they have Spanish people speaking Spanish in the show, they will have it in English so that we know what's going on. But they make that specific point here to not translate, because Hank can't understand what they're saying, so neither can we. So yeah, we see this really clearly when they go to meet their informant. The lack of Spanish is something that's just, he's just not qualified to be there really on a certain level because of that. And this whole gung-ho style that he does, you know, this like tough guy, whatever you want to call it, it doesn't really fit in with how they do things. I mean, they're working with high level people in the cartel who they have to, on some level, appease if they want to keep them, you know, giving them good information. I mean, they're putting their lives on the line. And, you know, he doesn't really seem to pick up on that at all. So as, you know, back in Albuquerque, after learning that Gretchen cut off the money, the very pregnant Skylar goes to apply for a data entry position where she used to work at Beneke Fabricators. She's getting the cold shoulder from pretty much everybody there, you know, the other people that are applying, the woman at the desk, but she's able to get around her and speak directly to Ted, the owner, and he offers her her old accounting job, which isn't, you know, better than what she was there to apply for. It's obvious that they have history, and later when she's talking to Marie, it sounds like that history could include sexual harassment. It's maybe not
Mr. Grabby Hands.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's the part that you know, you say sexual harassment and you think, okay, that's the lead here. But I think in another way, like the fact that she kind of, you know, she kind of like explains it away to Marie is kind of telling there, right?
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. We'll get into that, I think, a little bit later.
Yeah. So when she comes in for her first day, she finds out that he's actually split up from his wife as well. Mm-hmm. This is something she didn't know whenever she went there in the first place. And she even tells, you know, Marie in that conversation that he's a family man and everything's okay. And he's not going to put that on the line for anything or whatever. So Jesse does go. He finally does leave the apartment. He goes to buy a TV, and then later he goes to meet with his crew. And he sells them on this new expansion plan, this exponential growth idea that Walt's cooked up. And then when he comes back to tell Walt that they're on board with it, Walt like immediately says that they're not charging enough. Like, he wants to take it to the next phase, which is, as he sees it, to corner the market and raise the price. And the big thing that happens in this episode is that Hank and his fellow agents go to meet with Tortuga. But instead of you know, making a bust or whatever they were going to do there, they get a message that from the cartel that they're on to them, that they know about this. And they get that in the form of a severed head on a tortoise that also happens to be rigged with explosives. And the only thing that saves Hank here is that because he gets so sick from seeing this head, he sort of has to excuse himself from the situation and sort of walks over to, you know, take a breath. He says he's going to go get a body bag or whatever. But that's at the exact moment that the other agent lifts up the head and the explosives go off. And I imagine it kills the one guy, the guy who did that for sure. And then it injures a bunch of the rest of them. And Hank just barely gets out of that. And based on what we know about him as a character, he's not going to be feeling too great about the way that played out either. And then finally, back at his apartment, you see that Jesse is starting to develop an interest in Jane after they had a short conversation out front. And she's really starting to get on his radar. And he invites her over to see his new TV. And while they wait for the satellite signal, she reaches out to hold his hand, and then the episode cuts to black. So what did you think about this episode? What were your overall impressions?
So I can clearly remember seeing this one for the first time and sitting up in shock when the severed head on the tortoise came into view, and then the second shock of the explosion itself. So when I tend to think of iconic Breaking Bad scenes, this is one that always comes to mind. I really love this episode. I love how it opens with the music video, the Narco Corrido. And if you're interested at all in that genre of music or because I knew nothing about it before listening to the Insider podcast, if this is something that you're interested in, go check out the Insider podcast because they spend like a good 20 minutes just talking about this genre of music and how they went about like filming it and writing it, et cetera, et cetera. So if that's behind the scenes stuff is your jam, you should go check that out. I also really like the budding romance between Jesse and Jane and how that's portrayed. And I love all the humor in this one. I think there's a lot of really great, funny lines that we'll get to those. What about you? What do you think about this one?
Yeah, I think the tortoise scene really does an effective job of making this a memorable episode. Otherwise, you know, we don't really know what's going on with the Beneke and the Jane stuff in the beginning. I mean, it's easy and with hindsight to go back and say, wow, this is really important stuff. I'm not sure if it played that way the first time I watched it, but you see this tortoise and I mean, they did a really great job of the whole thing. I mean, that really resembles Danny Trejo there on when it comes into frame. Right close up. I mean, it's crazy. And the explosion, everything. I mean, the way that they put the sound together there, just something that, you know, you couldn't really see coming. Like, I don't think anybody would have, you know, thought, oh, I get it. This guy's name's Tortuga. So this is going to be a scene where we're going to see a tortoise blow up with his severed head on it or whatever. You know what I mean? It's like, it was definitely something that was like, oh shit. Okay. This is the kind of TV show we're watching here, I guess, you know, like this is something. And you met the teaser too. I think the first time you see this teaser, you're like, what is this? You know what I mean? It's like a low rent, rock video, you know what I mean? Or not a rock video by genre, but you know what I'm saying? You know what I mean? It's like a music video. And so, mm-hmm. It's really intriguing, and it goes really well with what happens in this. But it's a sort of a thing of like, you're just sort of like, what is this? Like, it's a little bit different than what they've done, you know, in the past. So it's interesting.
Yeah, and it's something that's meant to be a separate from this world. So the way Vince Gilligan explained like his conception of this music video is it's something that happens in the future, right? So mm-hmm. once Heisenberg, you know, starts to build a reputation and he, you know, the mythology of him as this drug kingpin and the choice of like showing someone that like kind of looks like has the telltale traits of Heisenberg without really knowing what the man's face looks like, that he's bald, he wears this pork pie hat and wears sunglasses. It's something that you can imagine happening in the future that starts to be informed by the actions that we see in this episode.
Yeah, exactly. Here. That's a much much more coherent way of tying those two things together. But that's exactly what I was thinking. Yeah. And I mean, that's, and I think that's the, like, you know, on the rewatch and talking about it right now, that's the thing that these choices that Walt makes in this episode are just completely inexplicable in a way. But, you know, we know who he is by now. We know where he's going. So it's like, yeah, it all makes sense, but damn, you know, maybe just hang out. Like, you know, like I keep, whenever I was watching it this time, I was thinking back to that, those scenes, you know, I think it was in 204 where Jesse's saying like, look, you're focusing on the negative, you know, like we're doing better. Like yesterday we couldn't sell anything. Now I'm bringing you like 15 grand and they're getting money and everything's going okay. But like he certainly can't leave well enough alone there at all. Like he's got to get his hands in there and make everything just way more volatile.
Yeah, he does. And before we get too much further into the episode, I just wanted to talk a little bit more about this music video, Cold Open. Mm-hmm. As the band, and I think they're called Los Cuates de Sinaloa. So it's like the friends or the cousins. Cuates is like slang, mm-hmm. For like hombre. It's like another way of saying hombre, de Sinaloa. And that's a state in Mexico.
Yeah.
And, El so Chapo. Like they're, yeah, they're like a legit band, music group that they hired, and Gilligan himself co-wrote the song for this music video. But I also did a little bit of research on the genre of music itself, but also more specifically on this figure of Jesus Malverde. So he's the statue, of course, that we see in the El Paso DEA mm-hmm. office. Where Hank is like, well, why do you have that figurine? And then, you know, the guy turns around and gives it to him.
But I love how he gives him the little one. Like,
yeah.
The actor does a pretty good just one episode thing. You know what I mean? Like he I don't know who that guy is. I didn't look up his name when I was watching it. But pretty cool little performance there.
Yeah, I thought so too. I thought everyone in the El Paso office did a great job. But this figure of Jesus Malverde, also he first appears in the music video. So on their guitars, they have the stickers of him. So that's that figure that with the mustache that we keep seeing. And then also there's a clip of someone that's supposed to be Jesus Malverde in the video, and he's like standing over a body. So I was curious, who is this guy? What is this about? Because I didn't know anything about it. But he comes also from the same state that our band comes from. So this, the Mexican state of Sinaloa. And he's a mythical figure. So I thought it was really interesting that they introduced this mythical folkloric figure into this episode. And specifically in this music video, because Heisenberg himself is also a figure, a mythical folklore mm-hmm. figure. So you have these two mythical figures together. So just a little bit of brief history on this guy. So Jesus Malverde literally translates to the bad green Jesus. And he is reputed to have like been some sort of like carpenter. So like the actual, you know, or the historical Jesus Christ, mm-hmm. A tailor or a railway worker or something like that. Allegedly, he was born in like 1870 and died just after the turn of the century, like 1909. And he is considered to be like a Robin Hood type figure. I thought it was pretty interesting how they worked that in, and just like, again, that parallel between mythical figures. So one who robs, you know, the rich to protect the poor sort of thing. Mm-hmm. And how he came to be synonymous with the drug cartel is an interesting history as well. If anyone is interested out there, you can look it up on Wikipedia.
Yeah, the one thing that I thought was really interesting about that, what they were talking about in the Insider podcast, was the idea that Vince went into it with the idea that he was going to make it about Heisenberg, like you're saying, like, you know, that he was this you know, he was coming onto the scene, and basically that they were lionizing him, right? But then mm-hmm. they told him, no, like, he has to be the bad guy. The cartel has to win. You know what I mean? So mm-hmm. so the, how they had to change that so that it was about the basically the, you know, the fact that Heisenberg is disrespecting, not doing things the right way, and then he'll eventually fall for it at the end, you know. That was kind of interesting.
That works really well with the genre of the narco corrido, which, if you don't know, that stands for a drug ballad. So the corrido just means ballad, and it's a genre in Mexican music. So the narco corrido is a subgenre, and it actually began, because I again did a little research on this, and it began like as early as like the early 1900s. Then over time, it became kind of a way for the drug cartel to propagandize their message. So often these bands, usually like in the north of Mexico, are hired or enlisted by the cartel to make songs that celebrate them and their, you know, whatever, their pursuits and things like that. So you can imagine that maybe this is something with that sort of knowledge that was paid for by the cartel. And it's interesting that we have the clips of like Tortuga, who we'll meet later in the episode, in this as well, because they know he's a rat, right?
Uh-huh.
So it's interesting thinking of this music video and the message in the broader context of what happens in this particular.
Yeah, it's cool. Like, I didn't, this was the first time I ever heard of anything like this was watching this episode. Like, it sounds like it was a pretty huge thing that was out there, but I guess where I grew up and you know what I was into, this just didn't come into that mix at all. But I think one of them said in the Insider podcast that one of the recordings that was available at Walmart was like the best selling.
Yeah.
The best selling thing. And like that, I mean, I had no, I mean, I just like, you know, I grew up in the Rust Belt. So there really wasn't much migrant culture at all, you know what I mean? Like it just wasn't really there when I was younger, so that wasn't something I experienced until I went out into other parts of the country. But yeah, it was huge, I guess. Huh.
Yeah, I also was unfamiliar with this genre of music, and I'm also an East Coaster, so I'm more familiar with like a Caribbean culture. So I'd never heard of the narco corrido before. Interesting stuff. But yeah, I guess probably if you live in the Southwest, you're probably very familiar with it, because it's not just music that's produced south of the border. It's also produced along like in along our side of the border.
Take a break. Wander around in a fugue state. We'll be right back.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
We're getting geared up for the 6th annual Summer Badass Fest. And while we're working on a slate of Apex badass films to enjoy, we've got an early action-packed announcement to make.
Just like last year, we're kicking off Badass Season with a live movie watch and podcast recording. We've rented out a theater for connoisseurs of action films and Bald Move fans that just want to have a great time.
Unlike last year, this year's movie is top secret. Hush, hush. No hints. Except, it's incredibly badass. It stars an absolute icon of the genre. We're willing to bet most of you haven't seen it, and it's going to be an incredible viewing experience with a packed house of Bald Movers.
Those of you who came to last year's screening of Total Recall know what a party it was. And those of you who didn't, now's your chance to experience it. Meet me and Jim. Order some custom movie-themed drinks at the theater's full bar. Then watch us record the full podcast for the movie. We reserved a venue over twice the size as last year, but seating is still limited.
It's happening Friday, June 21st at 7 p.m. in our hometown of Cincinnati. Get full details and buy tickets at baldmove.com/live.
Cincinnati's actually a pretty great city to visit, and we've got lots of details for side adventures on our event page as well. The Reds are playing the Boston Red Sox in their fantastic Riverside Stadium. The thrills of King's Island just minutes away, and I'll be leading a kayak trip down the scenic Little Miami River on Saturday.
Again, get full details and get your tickets now on our Badass Fest 6 page at baldmove.com/live.
Here are the highlights coming up this week on Bald Move.
For Prestige, me and Aaron are still extending our Shogun Afterglow with part 3 of our discussion of the 1980s TV miniseries. Last week absolutely shocked our sensibilities with Lord Toranaga doing the tango. What delights and horrors will await us this week?
Then for Pulp, this Friday join us for our latest prep session for House of the Dragon Season 2 as we take another look at the key differences between the text of Fire and Blood, the on-screen action for Season 1, and what they mean for the characters, story, and setting. Get your Valyrian steel sharpened for the new season.
You can find these and many other great podcasts by searching for Bald Move Pulp or Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app.
Fire up the RV. We're back with more Growth, Decay, Transformation.
All right, so maybe we can kind of just sort of skip, you know, sort of jump from story to story here, because there's a short shot of, it's probably the least significant classroom trip we have with Walt, where he refuses to give this kid 2 points, right? He had a failing grade, but he needed 2 more points. He comes in to beg, and Walt says, "Don't bullshit a bullshitter," and won't change his grade for him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the tough teacher. So I was also, because I always feel like they put in interesting lines from Walt in these classroom scenes that give some, again, a broader understanding to what happens in the episode. So I look for them every time we see that. And the only thing that really...
It's a strong force of attraction this time.
Yep. That's what I have written down.
I knew where you were going.
A bond is a strong force of attraction. So, and maybe we should just get into it because we've been dancing around it already. But this force of attraction that we see with Jesse and Jane, but also with Skylar and Beneke. And I think there's a lot to unpack with what happens with Skylar and Beneke, because Pete, I think you mentioned when you were talking about your impressions that like nothing really stood out to you like the first time you watched it. And of course, hindsight, we are like, oh, this is how it all began and stuff like that. And something interesting about both of these relationships is how doomed they are. So it's a fatal attraction.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And there are little subtle visual cues that we get throughout this. So let's maybe start with Skylar and Beneke, because I think there's some really interesting stuff that happens. So first and foremost, she doesn't tell Walt that she's applying or got this job. And you mentioned in the synopsis, like when she's talking with Marie, that's when we learn that there is this history where there was some sort of sexual interaction between them before. So, and then Walt walks in and Skylar's like, you know, she gives the hand signal, like, don't say anything to Marie, because Walt doesn't yet know that she got this job. So I thought it was really interesting that she doesn't tell him, and he has no idea.
Yeah, Junior tells him.
Yeah, she's walking out the door, right? Like, to go to work. So I thought that was really interesting. And I was wondering, like, why that choice. So, because, like, I think you could read a lot of duplicity into her motivations. But I think there's more that maybe might go into it. Like, he may not want her to work. And he does start to protest. Like, what about the baby? Do you think this is a good idea in your condition? Yada, yada, yada. And he starts to get upset, but he doesn't really have there is an opportunity to really have that conversation, because she has got 1 foot out the door already.
Strategically, it makes sense to do it that way for her, because she could say, hey, I knew you wouldn't let me do it, and we need this money, and this is the only way that I could, you know, go about it. It's not really, we kind of talked when we had Aaron on last time about where they were at the last, you know, I kind of thought that Walt was thinking that he got a little bit of a, you know, like a little bit of a reset as far as sort of the situation, the cold shoulder and everything else that had been happening. And it wasn't really resolved at that. And so here we just see her basically taking matters into her own hands, right? She's rather than just go out and be nowhere for you know, he's back at work. So she takes up the, you know, this opportunity to go get a job herself, and she can get some money. And but there's also a lot of other stuff going on, it seems like, as we're watching it, right?
Yeah.
So it's a very interesting choice to do that all. Because I said it does make sense strategically. If she thinks that he wouldn't let her do it, to go about it this way. But yeah.
Yeah, and there are a couple of things that stood out to me rewatching it. So, of course, when in the morning when they're having breakfast, as she's getting ready for her first day at work, Junior says something like, notice something different, and she's dressed up, right? And Walt's first reaction was like, is there a funeral? Right. And Skylar's like, it's got a lower neckline. Right. And that's not something that you would typically wear to a funeral. So I thought she looked really beautiful. Like, she put a lot of effort into looking nice. It's sort of flirtatious. Right. And it goes beyond just like looking apart. And we actually see the behavior is really quite flirtatious, both when she first goes for the interview and then when she goes to her first day at work. And well, something that stood out to me in that scene as she's unpacking in her office is she knocks over the picture of Walt and Walt Jr. on her desk. And when she picks it back up, it's got a huge crack in it. And the crack is right over Walt. And then, of course, then he tells her that he and his wife, Denise, split up. So this, we have the visual split across Walt. We have this idea of like a funeral, so maybe, you know, metaphorically the death of their relationship. I think, you know, it's a little on the nose, right, with like what they're trying to show us is going on here. So there's a split between Walt and Skylar and their relationship and the death of that relationship as well. And I appreciate, you know, like why they would do that figuratively, right, and stuff like that. And I went on a little bit of a rant in 605 talking about like the way they portray Skylar. And I don't think it's fair, though, to really say that the dissolution of this relationship is her fault and because of what happens with Beneke. I think, you know, Walt has already started that split. And maybe even without the benefit of Beneke, right, it would have been irreparable. I don't know. But Skylar's an interesting character and the choices she makes. Like, why does she decide to go back there to look for a job? On the surface, you could be like, well, she worked there before. It makes sense. She's familiar with the company. She knows the people that work there. But I think it was heavily implied, at least with the way she was looking at the photo of Beneke and Down, that this is something that she was thinking of. And when she goes there and the way she's flirting with him, it's, I think, a little unclear at the beginning if she's using her feminine wiles to try to get this job back. Like, there's the shot of her when she first goes to interview and she, like, you know, runs past like the girl at the front and she goes and knocks on his window, and like the shot of her like through the blinds, and she's got like those Betty Davis bedroom eyes going on, you know. I was wondering like if that's her using, you know, what's at her disposal to get this job, especially the way that whole scene is set up with all the judgment on her, everyone staring at her belly, you know, this hugely pregnant woman trying to get a job. And so I don't know. I think it's interesting the way they did this.
I'm not really sure. I was going to ask you the same thing whenever I was looking at the notes earlier. There's two ways you could interpret that, right? You could say that she still thinks about Ted, like, you know, like because of that shot of her looking at the photo, like she thinks, you know, that there's something that she wants to explore there with him, you know, maybe not trying to go beyond office flirting or something like that. But, you know, maybe there's something that she gets there, or she could be using it just saying like, look, this guy, he made a mistake from her opinion, right? That she can, you know, she can kind of use that as a way to get a job.
Yeah, leverage.
In a situation. Yeah. And I don't know. I mean, you definitely wouldn't be able to say just based on this episode, but it's an interesting question going forward, because one thing that I think, you know, that I think about when I watch it now is, God, Ted is so slimy, right? Like, the whole thing that he's setting up here is like, you think, oh, he likes her, so he's giving her preferential treatment, but he's actually putting her into a position that he knows, like, that there's fraud going mm-hmm. on, right? Like, all of that is front loaded in his, you know, like, he's thinking, okay, well, this is someone that I can work with because she's really good. Maybe she can fix this for me.
Yeah.
Knowing full well that it's not just a matter of, like, having the right person. You need to have someone who's willing to, like, break the law, right? Isn't that kind of how it plays out?
Yeah, I agree completely. And I have that in my notes as well. It's a mutually exploitive relationship, because the way I read it is that she's going in there knowing this history between them. And maybe, you know, there's some interest there. She likes the attention, perhaps, certainly with things
really,
being as bad as they are. But it's really, I think, to get the job. Like, she's using everything to get that. Because
that is
job.
Her problem, right? Yeah. Like, her problem is money. It's not that she feels underappreciated or she's just looking to spice things up. I mean, she's her primary motivation is that they were just her husband's dying, he's in this expensive treatment, and they don't have any money.
Exactly.
You know.
Yeah.
So it's great the way they set this up, in that they are exploiting each other without, you know, really understanding why the other person is doing what they're doing, which is always a good way to introduce a relationship in a television show.
Yeah, it's gonna, you know, it's doomed from the beginning. And just one last point on this. I think one of the things with Skylar is that there's, and it's not just with her character, it's with all the characters, there's a degree of ambiguity in her actions. Like, I think it's really up to us as viewers to try to sort of figure out what's going on, what is motivating her, what is she doing. And I think, Pete, it's really important what you just said to really remember why she is doing this. She's not just going out searching how does Saul describe it? Dirty, dank, and deep, you know?
Yeah.
She's she's looking to actually bring in some money. But Skylar is one of those characters, as we've been talking about somewhat already, is very controversial, and people feel very strongly about it. But do you want to talk about Jesse and Jane and the similarities and differences between their budding relationship?
Yeah, I just want to just to tie that up, though. I did want to talk about Marie situation again. I mean, like I said, you can see that now, as it's really telling. But I that was something that jumped out at me at this time. Like, how quickly she sort of tried to steer her away from, you know, putting that on Ted. Like, you know, he was so drunk, he was practically slurring his words. You know what I mean? Like, she was really giving him the benefit of the doubt there. Because the reason I'm bringing it back up one more time was because later you see that she lied to Walt about why she left in the first place, because she wouldn't explain this to him, right? He says, I thought that the fumes was the reason that you left in the first place, the welding fumes, you know what I mean? So Walt has no idea about any of that, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's the implication, is that something happened between them. She didn't feel comfortable continuing there after the fact. And then, you know.
You think so? So you think Skylar left because of whatever happened with Beneke?
Well, I mean, it could just be the fumes. But I guess that was my impression when I watched it this time, was that she left because of what happened. But now she's willing, because of the situation and being desperate, that she thinks that she can manage it and it'll be okay.
That's interesting. You know what I mean? I just took her at her word, because she said that she left before to focus on family. So I don't know how long ago she worked at Beneke's, but, you know, maybe that's when.
Well, it was before she was pregnant. So that's why I thought it seemed out of place. You know what I mean? If she was pregnant, that's why Walt brings it up. He's like, you can't be around those fumes. And she makes this ridiculous thing that they have some kind of green welding now or something that she's clearly making up as she goes along. Right. So, yeah, I thought that all amounted to her feeling uncomfortable there, not wanting to be at the, you know, at the office anymore, and then having to make up that story for Walt so that he didn't, you know, question why she didn't want to keep working there.
I don't know. It's an interesting point. I don't think I have enough information on how she felt about that initial situation apart. I mean, she mentioned it to Marie. She told Marie the story, obviously, because Marie knew what happened. And Marie is horrified that, you know, that she would go back and work for this guy. So you may be onto something there. And
Because she says, you know, is Mr. Whenever Grabby she hands. Says she's going back, that's the first thing she says is Mr. Grabby Hand still there? So that, I guess that's the stuff that I was putting together that made me think that, you know, the reason she's minimizing his behavior is because she has to justify the idea of going back there, you know?
Yeah, could be. And just one other thing about that scene with Skylar and Marie is, and this is true for Marie throughout the series, but she's kind of the stand-in or the conduit for the judgment of everyone else in the show, but also like the audience, right? So again, when Skylar is first applying for the job and how she's sitting there filling in her form or whatever, and there are some other women that are clearly there applying for the same job and they're all looking at her pregnant belly. And I love the line she says, big lunch, right? And then also the girl, Beneke's secretary, is looking at her stomach and you can see like the real tight lips and the judgment and stuff like that. And then Marie actually puts voice to that, though. She's like, as big as you are, you know, they're willing to work around that, I guess. Right. So we've talked a lot about this role of Skylar as the mother and as the perfect mother and what mothers are supposed to do and how they're supposed to behave. So smoking and now getting a job and now flirting with someone else, you know, she's committing all these cardinal sins of what it means to be a good wife and mother. So I can see why people really don't like her character. I don't think it's a fair judgment, but I understand where that comes from.
So, I mean, we're in agreement that Ted is a slime ball.
Oh, yeah.
On the opposite end of the spectrum, though, Jane, I mean, you got to kind of really enjoy this character introduction, huh?
Mm-hmm. And I think what's really interesting about their relationship again, and we got to see a little bit of how Jane thinks and feels about Jesse and Jesse's situation from when he first, you know, goes there to rent the apartment. And she changes her attitude when she finds out he has this kind of shitty family and she can relate to that. And then she gets to meet who she thinks is his father, who's very controlling and domineering and is like, well, you have to let me in. This is my son. And she's like, no, you know, and she really goes to bat for Jesse. And I mean, not only is she being a good like landlord, right, and protecting the privacy of her tenants, but I think that endears her to him in a way because, you know, her own dad, as she'll later tell Jesse, is a real hard ass. And so she might, again, that might be something that's appealing to her in a way that she relates to him more. So watching that scene when Jesse, you know, has the cup and he's like listening along the wall, something similar like that I never noticed before, but because I was watching this episode closely, is like we get all the shadows of the blinds throughout his apartment as he's doing that. So again, like I was thinking of the scene with Skylar behind the blinds at Beneke. So you get this idea of like peeking through a barrier, right? And trying to see like if there's something going on here, searching for signals, perhaps. And then he goes outside and she's outside and having the cigarette and watching it. I'm like, Jane, don't do it. Don't go look at his stupid TV. I'm like, don't do it. Just because.
Just run away.
Right? That fatal attraction there.
Yeah. I don't know if I ever appreciated the performance as much. I mean, I always liked the character. She's a great, you know, like you have this Walt, you know, you have this whole thing of Walt and the way that he just sort of bashes Jesse. You know, he does it a few times in this episode. It's nice to see somebody show an interest in Jesse that isn't, you know what I mean? You know, that she's not really, I mean, of course she's got an agenda as far as like he's her tenant and everything else. But like, I mean, she's always been a pretty good, you know, balance for what's going on and with Jesse and his relationship with Walt. And, I'm not sure if I ever realized that, you know, the performance is really good. Like she does a really great job of sending all those signals and playing all that without talking too much, without saying much, you know what I mean? It's a lot of subtle stuff, but she obviously like, you're at least for me, like I was like, okay, yeah, this is a cool character. I want to know more about her. I want to know, like, you know, I want her to be in the show, like not just a guest actor. Like, I want to see more of her going forward, you know?
She's, of course, she'll end up becoming a foil to Walt. So she's integral to the plot in that regard. But I also, I love the pairing of Jesse and Jane because she seems so far out of his, I don't want to say his league necessarily, but like out of his world. Like
she kind of does, you know.
Yeah. I mean, cause she's so, you can tell that this is a bright individual. And she's smart, but she has her own history, obviously. She has her own problems and troubles and stuff like that. And
I guess that not to interrupt, but I think that's what I was trying to grasp a hold of there is that, of course, she comes off as she's really confident and she's, like you said, sharp. Like she's got all these positive traits, but you can also tell that there's something else going on below the surface, right?
Yeah.
That comes out even in these early interactions that, of course, like we pointed out that we saw that she has an attraction to the fact that his home situation was bad and that there's some kind of connection there. But I think in this episode, you can see that, yeah, she comes off as like, you know, being all business and really, really kind of put together. But there's a secret in there, right?
Yeah, and you really start to see the cracks in this facade that she puts on, that she's this tough, hardened, doesn't take bullshit from anyone person, where she really has this soft spot, this weakness for that, mm-hmm. whatever that shared trauma is that she perceives with Jesse. And I think it's really Jesse's naivete and his innocence that speaks to her, right? Like everyone, that maybe the way she perceives him is the way that we are largely primed to see him as well, that this is just, he's a good kid. He has a good heart.
Yeah.
And he just needs a break, right? Everyone kind of uses him and manipulates him and shits on him and has, you know, his family's unfair to him and he doesn't deserve any of it. And that probably has a lot of to do with herself and her own history with her family, with her father in particular, and her trauma and past. She's projecting, I think, a lot of that onto him.
I'm just really happy that he cleaned up all those Funyun bags before he invited her.
Yeah.
One of the most underrated things about this is the amount of empty Funyun bags that they put in his bedroom on the ground. I don't think I noticed just how many there were when I watched this episode before.
Yeah, they're everywhere, all over the counter, all over the floor.
He says, give me my weed back. It helps with my nausea. And I'm thinking, like, yeah, that's maybe because of all those Funyuns that you ate. Like, you know, you haven't been in there that long. That's not good for the stomach.
I mean, it works for his cover, though, in one of the previous episodes when he tells Hank that, you know, he was hiding up in the hotel room just eating vending machine food with Wendy. And also when they break down later in the desert and all he brought was Funyuns, right? I don't know how Jesse survives, but.
Classic line, you're a good drawer.
Yeah.
They set that up pretty good with him, you know, him looking at his drawings from when he was younger and kind of thinking back about that. What do you think about the guy on the chopper who comes by and calls him out there?
Hey, Pinkman, you're Pinkman. You're the man.
Yeah.
I thought it was sweet how Jesse came clean to her. And, you know, again, like thinking about Jane and her attraction to Jesse, she knows he's lying. And he confesses, you know, this isn't really my name. That guy wasn't really my dad. And she doesn't care, you know, like thinking again of her attraction to him, it really seems against all better judgment.
Yeah, I think it's funny. That's a good scene because she obviously knows that when the guy comes by on the motorcycle that his last name is Pinkman.
Yep.
Like, it doesn't really need to be made. It doesn't really need to be made. He doesn't have to clarify that. But because of who he is, and like you said, is sort of like he's a naive kind of person in that way. Like, so he comes out and he says that. I don't think there's any manipulation at all there, right? Like, that's just him
Well, he's so
trying to come clean.
He's so stupid. He didn't realize it. right? When the guy called out his name, mm-hmm. and he's just like, you know, he's kind of embarrassed that this guy called him out, like, just because this guy recognized him, right? That's just because of the story going around town that he killed Spooge. But he doesn't seem to recognize that he called out his name until she says it, and she goes, "Pinkman, huh? I thought your name was Jackson." And then you see the look on his face. He's like, "Oh, yeah. Shit." And he just walks away. You know, he knows he's been had there, but it didn't occur to him until she mentioned it.
Right. So, yeah, so he does that. He comes clean. She already knows the answer. She doesn't point that out to him. She just lets him have his moment. And it does seem to endear, you know, him to her. Like, you know, she finds that to be a good quality, you know, that he's doing this, even though it should be painfully obvious that he doesn't need to. So, yeah, that's an interesting little interaction there, because he started off on the wrong foot, right? He lied about everything.
Mm-hmm. But I mean, she kind of knew that, though. Like, she,
yeah, but it, yeah. She just sort of upped the price, yeah, you know.
Yeah, the DBAA fee.
Yeah, and so, yeah, so it's, so neither one of them, there's, I think that that's another thing. I really like the choice of the way that they actually, you know, move to the next step, which is they're inside and Jesse is, like, making all this ridiculous small talk about, you know, it's got Dolby 6. Whatever, yeah. And it's got the really, really, really black blacks, you know, like the basically the stuff that the salespeople would tell you when you go into Best Buy or whatever, you know, the store is.
Or isn't it his friends that talk about it? Was it Combo?
Yeah, they were doing the same thing when he, yeah, they were had their, the, that's what I thought of in that conversation too, was that it's all just like, you know, they're just saying stats that you would get from, you know, reading an ad or something like that. But so, you know, he's sitting there, and then they have her choice to reach out to hold hands, and in that awkward silence, and that's kind of, it looks like really sweet when you see it the first time, right? Mm-hmm. And you're like, oh, well, that's cool, you know, she made the move. But then, you know, when you think about it later, that sort of sets the tone for you know, how they interact as a couple too then, right?
How do you mean?
I mean, she's going to...
She takes the initiative, you mean, kind of dominates? Yeah. Yeah,
yeah. Yeah, that's sort of the way that it's headed. You know, it doesn't look like that when you watch this, but then, you know, whenever you think back, you're like, oh yeah, she did make the first move, didn't she?
Yeah,
you know?
She did. And, you know, when I was thinking of the teaser for this episode and thinking of budding romances, how awkward Jesse is, and he's just trying to fill the silence, and she's quite comfortable sitting in the silence, just staring ahead, and you can't read her face, it's expressionless. And I love the way they did that, and we'll talk more about this later when we get to favorite, you know, favorite shot. Yeah. there's a lot I want to say about this, but I don't want to get too far ahead of ourselves there. But thinking specifically of Jesse, though, and I love the way Aaron Paul plays that. And thinking of, again, awkwardness, so we get to see how awkward Jesse is in this situation where he really feels out of his element. And as we were saying, you know, she's somewhat out of his league and trying to impress her. And then maybe this is a good time to transition to talking about Hank and someone who is really out of his element and how awkward.
Speaking of being out of your element.
Seriously. So man. Hank in El Paso.
Yeah. And I think that this is something that I probably didn't appreciate at first, but this is great, because this is the character. This was one of my major, you know, this is a person that this is a character that I did not care about in the beginning. I actively disliked. I was like, why does this guy have to be in this show? The first time I watched this, through the first couple of episodes, you know what I mean? And so I really liked the idea that those things that I didn't like about him are exactly the reasons why he doesn't fit in at this new job. You know what I mean? Like, that's a great read on how this character has been constructed, I think.
Yeah. So, I mean, he's used to being a big fish in a small pond in Albuquerque. And mm-hmm. even the DEA of El Paso kind of talk about that, you know, when they're out in the field and they're looking for Tortuga. Maybe he's like, you know, hot stuff down there. But and then you bring him really out of, you know, fish out of water sort of thing here. He's so awkward. And one of my favorite lines in that scene is how he's like, yeah, a great group of guys. Oh, and gals, right? Like he's suddenly, you know, conscientious of these things. And what we've been presented with Hank so far is, you know, he's really big on this sort of sexist, misogynistic talk, you know, talking about getting tuggies from Shania Twain and stuff like that, you know? So for him to suddenly be aware of his surroundings and that really painful laugh that he does. Pete, you already mentioned it when they start speaking Spanish and they don't subtitle it for us. And Hank has no idea what they're saying. And then he comes in,
And he just laughs because everyone else is laughing.
Oh, it's so good. So funny. It's painful.
The whole, please, senor, or, you know, whatever, no DEA, please, you know, when he does his voice. I mean, like, that's about as tone deaf as you can get, right?
Yeah, definitely. So the senor Sante, he's like Saint Senor.
Yeah.
I'm referring to Malverde, the bad green. So really tone deaf. It's making fun of an accent. You shouldn't do that. Yeah.
Yeah, and I think what this does is it does show that, you know, when we talked about in the in Tuco's Last Stand, when we were talking about it, you remember I said he can do his job, right? You know, and you brought up the point that can he, you know, and I was saying, yeah, in that moment he did, but you know, this is kind of showing that he was never really cut out for this job. You know what I mean? Like for what it really is, like the in the field stuff, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, of course there's a cumulative effect of like, yeah, he was in the shootout and now this is horribly violent or whatever else, but that is also his job and one that he sort of took a lot of pride in, you know, being so good at it or whatever, you know what I mean? And that's a pretty interesting revelation for a character to have, right? This be like, what the hell is wrong with me? Why am I not able to do this? I mean, that's a pretty compelling internal conflict, right?
Oh, I definitely agree. And thinking of what,
like your whole thing is, I'm a tough guy.
Yeah,
I'm the biggest tough guy in the room. And now that you've actually gotten to the point in your career where you have to, you know, follow through on that, it's not going so well.
Well, you mentioned a couple minutes ago that he was tone deaf by mocking like a Hispanic accent, like a Mexican accent, right? But it's more than that. Like he is really out of touch with the culture of El Paso, right? Like if you're going to be dealing with the cartel, you should definitely speak the language, right? And he clearly doesn't. And you should really understand that culture, which I think to the point that the other officers were making, you need to know your enemy, right? And he starts quoting, was it Sun Tzu and like the Art of War and stuff like that. And I think Hank this in a way, it kind of exposes one of his weaknesses, not just from being in this situation where he is so out of touch, right? But also his problem back home in Albuquerque, too. He's so sure of himself. And that blinds him to certain realities, I think, that he's not able to really see his enemy. The enemy doesn't have to speak a different language or have a different skin color or come from a different country, because we know his real enemy, you know, is his brother-in-law, right? And that's something I think that is really interesting. That's I think that this whole interaction he has with the El Paso DEA really gives a much deeper understanding to I think his character and his shortcomings, if you will.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and like I said, I think whenever I was doing the synopsis, I was saying that it becomes really clear in that hotel room, because, like, you know, they've been working with this guy. It's been paying dividends. Of course he's annoying and he's the turtle, you know, he takes his time but he always wins, and yeah, you know, that's, you know, it's not something that is like great, you know what I mean, that this guy's obviously a criminal and you're buying him stuff out of a catalog to get the information or whatever, but you know, you have to sort of, like, there's things like that you have to deal with, and you have to be able to adapt. And he doesn't really look capable of it in the way that he interacts here.
Yeah, I mean, to him, it's a gross overstepping of the law, right? That, like, that this guy, Danny Trejo, who is so great in this episode, I love his character so much, mm-hmm. as Tortuga. It's so offensive to Hank that this guy should be able to control the narrative, control what's happening in the room. It's just offensive to him, right? And he's trying to project, mm-hmm. this image that he always tries to project, that we're the tough, you know, macho DEA, and, you know, we knock down doors and take names and yada, yada, yada. But that's clearly not how things work down there. And that's something that he really has a hard time coming to terms with. So I love how he's humbled in that scene. And then, of course, he'll be humbled in an even greater way, won't he?
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know if we need to really add too much more about the actual explosion. I think we sort of touched on that. I did pick up from the Insider podcast that they had to shoot part of that in the studio. Mm-hmm. And when you go back and watch it, you can kind of see the one, whenever he's looking through the binoculars, you can see the head on the tortoise, and it's pretty obviously, like, if you know it's there, it's pretty obvious, like, where they built that as a set for that one particular shot or whatever. But otherwise, it's just a really, I mean, you know, this is TV. This isn't, you know, a feature or whatever. And this is a pretty, as far as, like, the way that the head looks and the way the explosion goes off and everything else, it's pretty well put together.
Yeah. What's the matter, Schrader? You act like you've never seen a severed human head on a tortoise before. And, you know, I think it was really...
Yeah. Famous last words.
Yeah. I thought it was really interesting, though, about why this, or how this bothers him so much. And because he's used to violence, right? And if you remember him finding Nodos and Tuco's brother-in-law, I'm blanking on his name. Gonzo.
Nodos and Gonzo. Yeah,
yeah. Nodos and Gonzo. And, you know, at that crime scene, you know, and how that he wants a photo with Stumpy and stuff like that. But certainly since the whole thing with Tuco, there's just been this shift with him. He's starting to experience PTSD, and he's horrified by that degree of violence, right? And again, maybe, like, this is an example of he doesn't really understand just how depraved the cartel is. This is another reminder that, you know, of Tuco, but on a much grander scale, right? Of that degree of violence and depravity, and it's just too much for him.
Yeah, I think that was the answer to your question, was that with Gonzo and Nodos, that was there was no threat there.
Yeah.
You know, like, there was gore and there was blood, and he thought that was hilarious. You know, he wanted to take a picture of it and put it on the equivalent of, you know, social media at the time, of him with Stumpy or whatever, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But I think post Tuco, was his life was really in danger, you know what I mean? And he barely got out of there. And I guess there's two ways you could look at that. As if you're in his shoes, you're thinking, I was up to the test. I was able to pull it off. But, like, there's a very real, you know, physical reaction, like, psychological effect that would have on you. And in this situation here, you know, it shows you very clearly that this dead severed head is, you know, he reacts to that completely different than he did to the body of Gonzo, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Because after that situation with Tuco, he's a changed man.
Yeah. And this is just, you know, further traumatizing him, but it's his trauma, mm-hmm. that arguably saves him from grievous bodily harm, right? It's because he's, yeah. so shocked, and then he says that, you know, he wants to go get an evidence bag, that he gets far enough away from the explosion where he's not physically harmed.
And he is able to get in there and put a tourniquet on, mm-hmm. on his buddy there.
Yeah.
His new best friend, who lost his leg, which is pretty gruesome as well.
It is. It is. And, you know, watching that particular scene with the DEA of El Paso, at least to me, I was reminded kind of Hank and Gomi and his crew back in Albuquerque and how they behaved at crime scenes. So they're really not too different. It's just that Hank mm-hmm. is so uncomfortable being in this new world, right? But something that stood out to me, like Hank was so offended that they were willing to strike this deal with Tortuga and buy him whatever he wanted out of the Sky Mall or whatever. And he thought, like, it read to me like he was thinking that they really valued or appreciated this guy and were willing to do whatever they wanted to him. But then you can see how casual they are when his head shows up on a tortoise. They are not bothered in the slightest. They did not give a shit about Tortuga mm-hmm. at all. They're laughing about it. Like, oh, you act like you've never seen this before. So that was just something that also stood out to me that, you know, that Hank really isn't too different from these guys, at least how he used to be in Albuquerque. It's just his perceived differences that are creating the barriers, I think.
Yeah. And, you know, he made himself the top dog in Albuquerque. Yeah. And, you know, you don't really know if this went over, if he stayed in this position and this never happened, he may eventually adapt. But at least for what's important for him, as far as the story is concerned right now, is that he's incredibly traumatized exactly. from the shootout with Tuco. And it's going to have ripple effects all the way down throughout, you know, the rest of the story for him.
You're listening to Growth, Decay, Transformation. We'll be right back.
Hey, it's time for another season of Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? The premise is simple. A Gen Xer and a millennial watch old 80s action TV to see what still works and what doesn't. In previous seasons, we've done podcasts for Knight Rider, Airwolf, MacGyver, A-Team, and more. However, this year we're doing a very special season of Feeny. We're going back and reviewing the very special episodes of 80s and 90s sitcoms. Come cringe along with us as Hollywood tries to warn our families of the dangers of underage smoking, drug abuse, alcoholism, eating disorders, and much more. We start out with the episode of Boy Meets World where a high school kid gets sucked into a cult. Worlds collide as the Mr. Feeny finally makes an appearance on Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? Join me and my buddy Jay each week for episodes full of nostalgia and secondhand embarrassment. And don't worry, if very special isn't your speed, we've also got some all-time classic Knight Rider episodes to close the season with. Find Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? Each Wednesday on Bald Move Pulp, starting April 3rd. Madman and father of Mad Max, George Miller, is back with another apocalyptic tale from the Australian wastelands.
This time, we're getting a prequel featuring the origin story of Charlize Theron's character Furiosa, starring the Queen's Gambit's Anya Taylor-Joy in the title role and the mighty Thor Chris Hemsworth as the warlord Dr. Dementis. Furiosa promises more high-octane, slightly radioactive action and fun.
Furiosa drives into theaters on May 24th, and we'll have our spoiler-free thoughts and impressions of the film, as well as a discussion of trailers and upcoming movies for everyone. But if you want to ride with us the full length of the podcast on the eternal highways of Valhalla, shiny and chrome, you're going to have to be a club member.
Join today at support.baldmove.com. Get our full discussion of Furiosa and many more first-run films, plus tons of other bonus podcasts and ad-free feeds.
Support.baldmove.com.
Tight, tight, tight. We're back with more GDT. So, I mean, what do we think about Walt here? Is he incapable of learning what you know from his mistakes?
Yes.
Like what's going on here?
Easy answer, yes. Walt does not learn from his mistakes like ever until like maybe like the last episode, right? of the series. Yeah. So, I mean, he's acting very much the way that Walt behaves. And it's frustrating for Jesse, I think, in particular, of course, because they'd set up this clear, as they say, division of labor. I do the cooking, you do everything else. But then Walt keeps, you know, overstepping these boundaries. Like, we need to be doing this, we need to be doing that. So now he wants to expand territory. Of course, he sees opportunity because everyone's scared of Jesse now because there's this. Again, so we've been talking about mythic, rather, I should say, characters. So, like, we have the Jesus Malverde, but now we also have this myth or mythos of Jesse Pinkman, you know, being the guy that's going to squash his enemies with ATM machines, right? So again, appealing to this idea of this power that they hold, Walt gets drunk on that and he's like, we need to, you know, take advantage of this, capitalize it, expand our territory and stuff like that. And I love how adamant Jesse is about, no, we can't do this, we can't do this. And then we get the whole blowfish speech and that changes Jesse's mind. But then Jesse carries over that same enthusiasm when he's talking to Badger, Skinny mm-hmm. Pete, and Combo, like, you know, we're going to be kings or knights or whatever he says.
I'm going to be a king and you're going to be like a duke or whatever.
Yeah. So like Jesse is so impressionable and I know you were asking
malleable.
About you were asking about Walt, but Jesse, you know, he's as you say, malleable and so easily persuaded, where his instincts are often the right ones. They should be listening to Jesse, because Jesse is like, this is a bad idea.
At least when it has to do with when it has to do with drug culture.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, if nothing else, he understands how that world that he's in works.
Yeah.
And Walt is just convinced that if he's incurious about it, if he just ignores the reality of how it works, that maybe he can bend it to his will, right?
Mm-hmm.
And what I think is so funny about this is that he goes and he sees Skinny Pete, Badger, and Combo, right? He knows who Jesse is. He knows that this is his army, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
Like, these are not the kind of people that you go out and take over neighborhoods with.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, these are
like, inspire a lot of confidence, right?
These are your neighborhood
stoners. They take like
stoners.
An active, it takes like an active, you know, you need to just, the cognitive dissonance is there.
Yeah, you need the muscle, you need the violence, and none of
and
those
these
guys.
These ain't those guys.
Yeah. Yeah. But again, Walt thinks that it doesn't matter. It's all about appearances, right? As long as people are scared of Jesse, they're going to deal. And then, I mean, Skinny Pete even says that, like, he didn't have to chase people down. Everybody was, and so, you know, I can see why Walt is attracted to the idea. And of course, it's a bad idea. There are a lot of bad ideas in this episode. This, you might as well just call this the episode of bad ideas. I mean, you could call the whole series that, but you see the seeds planted for a lot of really, really, really bad ideas that are going to, you know, take root further along in the series.
Two things that I want to touch on here was, one, I think it's hilarious that whenever, just to go back to Skylar talking to Ted, he asks how Walt's doing, and she says, oh, he's just plugging along, you know? and that's a fair description of what he was doing all the way up into the beginning of this series, right?
Mm-hmm.
He's just plugging along. Of course, she's leaving out the idea that he has cancer and all this other stuff. But, like, as far as he's concerned, he's obviously up to something, but still, no way that she could guess that he's trying to take over territory through a program of exponential growth and meth manufacturing.
Yeah.
But then the other thing is that I wonder, is this all then, like, if we... Like, we're watching closely, we're talking about every single thing that happens and that stands out on a rewatch. Is this all still a reaction to that idea of him, you know, Jesse, him, like, the fact that he needs Jesse more than Jesse needs him? Is this him, like, lashing out in a way that is maybe not even that apparent to him?
I don't know. I really think this comes down to economics.
Or is this just desperation? Because there is that shot of him when he comes home and you see him go straight into the bathroom and start coughing.
Yeah, I think that's something we haven't mentioned. We see that he is coughing a lot, and we'll later learn it's, what is it called? Radiation pneumitis or something like that. But, you know, in his head, what is he thinking? What does he think is...
That's what I'm wondering.
Yeah, going on
with
him.
Is it a reaction to... I mean, it's probably all the above. Yeah. I mean, we're doing a podcast talking about breaking this down. So, you know, we can look at it that way. But I think that's an interesting question, right? Is it a reaction to the fact that he's losing control in this relationship with Jesse? So he wants to do something insane because that's the way he reacts to that kind of situation? Or is it that his desperation is just increasing because he thinks he's dying and he wants to make it happen faster and the consequences just don't matter?
I think for him it's simply economics. He just wants the money, right? And certainly after he finds out that his wife is going back to work, which is something he doesn't approve.
Right, so that makes for an interesting parallel there, right? Because she's doing the same thing.
Exactly, and they both even use the word economy. Well, she says economy because like when you know, she explains to Ted why she's applying for the job, she says, well, you know, the economy. And then Walt's thinking about how like they can corner the market and raise their price, et cetera, expand their territory. Again, he's thinking of economics. And another really interesting parallel between Walt and Skyler, you could say, and we've already talked a lot about it, but just to put it more succinctly in a sentence, what they're both doing is they are crossing into new territories, dangerous territories, forbidden territories that they shouldn't be going to in search for money, right? And for financial reasons. So Skyler is crossing perhaps a fidelity line, a marital line, and Walt is going to put dealers into, you know, onto streets that don't belong to him. And in both cases, there's a lot of fallout, right? Like we can see how none of this is a good idea. And costs them dearly in several ways. So with Beneke, it costs like the money that he needs to get out of town when he's afraid of Gus, right? Because she gives the money to Ted. And they're going to lose Combo as a result of what they're doing here. So again, like something you always say, Pete, is this feels like a setup episode, setting up the things for what's going to happen later. And this, I think, is very much, again, one of those setup episodes. We're getting... As I said earlier, the seeds are planted to see like how all this bad shit's going to go down.
Would you say that it's layered?
Like nachos?
Yeah. Layered like nachos. There was a good Combo. I like Combo. He's a great character. He's like somewhere in between, right? Like he's almost competent.
That might be generous.
But I mean, like that's not right. Yeah, okay, he's not almost competent, but he's the one that seems to be almost self-aware. Does that make sense?
He certainly seems smarter than Badger, who I think is the dumbest of the group by far. Badger's really stupid.
I don't know. Skinny Pete isn't exactly
Einstein.
He's not winning any spelling bees or, you know, he's
STREAT.
They're both. Yeah, I guess it's a low bar, I guess, is what we're saying. Yeah. But Combo, sometimes he has these moments of like self-awareness, like that. Yeah, I'm dumb, but I know that I'm dumb. So it's OK.
Well, certainly compared to Badger and Skinny Pete, like he's definitely smarter. He's a cut above. But as you said, the bar is pretty low. From what we know of Combo, right, like he seems like, you know, just like a normal guy. And I mean, he's obviously mixed up with some bad people. He likes to party. He steals an RV from his own mother, which is pretty awful. He still lives with his mother, you know, so he's a loser, right? Like guy is... at least he's depicted that way. Not to say that if you still live at home with your mom, you're a loser. But, you know, the fact that he steals from her and he just goes to like titty clubs and he just gets high all the time, you know.
Yeah. And I mean, whenever you see them, the cops talk to her about that, whenever it's Hank that goes to talk to her, right? You see that, you know, he did strain their relationship quite a bit beyond that.
Mrs. Ortega. That's a sad scene. What a great actress she was. They get a lot of really great supporting guest actors. So
yeah, but I was the line that he says here that I really liked was he says, "Ain't got no confusions and interpretations as to who we work for." And it's like one of those lines they give those characters where they're just like they're making it up as they go along, like they're just trying out language, you know what I mean? Like this is a word I could probably pull off here, you know. I love the way that they do that.
It's, again, it's kind of like, you know, like what his interpretation of like what it's like to work for the cartel or something like that. Because it's similar to a line that we hear. I think Nodos is the one who says, like, just don't forget who you're working for. And that's when Tuco beats him to death. So like this idea of like, you know, showing respect and paying your respect. So, you know, it is a clumsy way of saying it, right? But they're scared. They're scared of Walt and, you know, this idea that Jesse could really be, you know, capable of that degree of violence.
It's a cool, I guess it's the Cold War Museum. Is that where they're at?
Yeah, the nuclear war. So they're playing like the song from, I think it was the 1950s, the duck and cover song that they used to play to teach kids how to like hide under their desks and stuff like that. And there's a picture of Werner Heisenberg, I think somewhere in the museum. So, of course, that's where Walt gets his nom de plume from. And, of course, all the explosions and stuff, you know, tortoises and so on and so forth.
So what about your favorite line then? What is your favorite line in this episode?
I had to go with, I'm a blowfish. You know, so that whole exchange when Walt is trying to talk Jesse up and everything. And just something that did just occur to me, Pete, that we didn't talk about. Because you kind of broached this idea, though, of like Walt and this power differential between him and Jesse. I think Walt gets some of that back in this exchange, right? So where Walt is able to illustrate to Jesse, of course, everything that Jesse just went through at the Spooge house also illustrates it to Jesse that he's no Tuco. But like how Walt is kind of like, you know, like she, like when he figures out that it was Mrs. Spooge who had Jesse's gun on him and everything, you know, Jesse kind of loses his street cred there. So this idea, this division of labor, Jesse sort of proves that he's not really up to the task. But so I do think that's something maybe we'll explore as we continue the series and this relationship between Walt and Jesse. But I had to go with the blowfish line because it's hilarious how Jesse repeats it over and over, you know, like a personal mantra. What about you? What was your favorite line?
I had to go. I think I mentioned some of the other ones that I was thinking of picking already, but the one I went with in the end was Jane and her first interaction with Walt. And she says, and you knocked, right? You know, as a question, but really like the line delivery there because Walt doesn't get it at all. He's just like, I want in, give me access, right? Mm-hmm. He's like a robot, you know, like this person is like completely insignificant. You know, like, can you, because it was funny because she says, can I help you? And he says, no, he doesn't even really think twice about it. And then he hears that she's the landlord or the manager. And he's like, oh, yes, I do need your help, come to think of it, right? So he, you know, he just sort of disregarded her because she didn't fit into, like, what he was doing. And then I really liked the way she came back with that. And you knocked, right? You know, like, and what happened, you know? Like, what does that mean when you knock on someone's door and they don't open? Put it together here.
It's also, I think, a great little insight into how Walt is really starting to think of himself as being above the law, right? So like, and I think Jane, you know, makes the case like why she can't let him in. It's, you know, he has rights, he's an adult and so on and so forth, even if Walt is his quote unquote father, right? It reminded me of that particular scene, reminded me of a scene that happens much later when Walt breaks into Saul's office and he crashes through the glass and like Francesca is like really pissed off about it. And she's like, now I have to like wait and get this freaking window fixed and yada, yada, yada. And like Walt doesn't consider other people at all. He's so self-centered. So I thought this was, he just doesn't give a shit about what anyone else thinks. He doesn't care about what the law is. He's just going to get what he wants.
And it does set her up, knowing what we know, to be a foil to him, like you said, you know.
Yep.
Like she's not intimidated by him right away, which is a nice signal from the character.
Yep, she is a barrier between him and Jesse right from their very very first meeting.
And so what about a shot? What was your favorite shot?
So there were a couple, right? Obviously, there were some really big ones to choose from in this one, and I didn't want to go with anything like too big, but there were two things that stood out to me. The first one is when Jesse is meeting with the boys at the Atomic Science Museum, and he's giving them that speech about how they're going to be, you know, they're going to own the city or whatever. I love the shot from like it's like from the floor up, and then you see like the four fists come in. I thought that was really really cool how they bumped their fists. But I had to go with the final shot of the episode with Jesse and Jane holding hands. I love that moment. We've already talked a little bit about it. I hinted that I was going to be talking about this as my favorite shot. And I love that the screen in front of them says, you know, searching for signal or acquiring satellite signal, searching. And so I took that as a visual rhetoric for he is searching for a signal himself, right? He's waiting for a sign from her because she's sitting there completely deadpan, not reacting at all. He's so uncomfortable. He's sweating. He's like looking nervously over his shoulder at her, and she's just looking straight ahead.
Dolby and then, 6 point whatever.
And then she just very quietly reaches her hand down and, you know, extends her fingers. And that's it. That's the signal that he was waiting for. So who cares about the satellite signal? He got the real signal that was important.
Yeah,
to
hopefully that TV never comes on now.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Black, it's black and blue, too. That's another one of those references to the title, you know, the blue screen with the black border around it.
Yeah. And of course, we know that the signal eventually does come on. We'll see that in the next episode. That's like the first time they're intimate. So like we know, like, yeah, we'll talk about that in the next one. What about you? What was your favorite shot of this one?
Yeah, well, I mean, mine would have been the same there. This is one of those situations where I think that is the hands down the most interesting one. But then you have this whole Tortuga situation. Yeah. So I defaulted back to that because the way that they shot that is, you know, like where it comes into, like you did have an idea of what it was, but it's so absurd the first time you see it, you're not even really sure what's happening, right? Like you see this turtle with Danny Trejo's head on it, and you're just like, is it a dream? Is he hallucinating? Like what's happening, right? So they show the way that they shoot this when it comes in, like, you know, it's, you see their legs and it's sort of the turtle kind of is being a turtle, you know, moving slow. And so it sort of just kind of reveals that. And the way that it reveals the Hola DEA, you know, that's painted on there is like, I think the timing of that and the way that it's all set up is really good because at least as far as I remember, I was like, what is happening here? What's going on? And like, oh, this is a sign, you know, like they knew that he was a, you know, like you put it all together as you're, you know, saying like, you know, as you're watching in real time, like, okay, so this is what's happening here. And I just thought that everything about that works really, really well. I mean, that's just, there's just nothing wrong with that. And it's always impressive to see something like that. So that was my favorite one.
It's such a great shot, too, and to really remember what it was like the first time you saw it. And as I said, like, I remember vividly seeing this and being like, oh, my God, there's a head on this tortoise. And then so that was shocking. But then they upped the ante by making it explode. And I was like, oh, this show is incredible, right?
And it even got a little bit crazier when I listened to the Insider podcast because I hadn't thought about wrangling a tortoise. I mean, like, this is a real
animal, yeah.
You know, animal.
What was his name? Otis?
And it's not like a dog. It's not like a dog, you know, I mean, you can train it to come to you or whatever. Like they, you know, they were talking about it, how they have to wait until it's dinner time, right?
To otherwise, show his lettuce.
no way that the turtle is doing anything, you know what I'm saying? So they have to wait until it's time for it to eat so that they can entice it with some lettuce. And his trainer, I guess, right? Like the woman who handles him or whatever was like calling his name and everything else. And it's like, yeah, it's really cool to think about how much went into that. And then like, it could have all went wrong. You know what I mean? Like they said later in the thing, the reason why they had to build the set was because after it gets cold a little bit, then he just sort of goes in his shell and he doesn't want to hang out anymore.
Yeah.
So they had to, they had to cut
it. Put him in his trailer with his heater on. Poor guy.
Yeah. Yeah. So fascinating all the way around. Just great, great, great craft there all the way on. I mean, the core, like the way that they all blow up, the way that the whole thing is put together is perfect. Really good.
Agreed. Yeah. This is a good one, from the music video to that explosion to the final scene with Jesse and Jane. All right. So if you enjoyed this episode, please be sure to follow our podcast and hit that bell for notifications. Please rate and review us wherever you listen to podcasts. And those who wish to support GDT can do so by going to our Patreon at patreon.com/growthdecaytransformation.
Yeah, you can find us on Twitter at BreakingBadGDT. And please write to us, you know, send us some feedback. Let us know what you're thinking about the episodes. Ask us questions if you want. We can put them together maybe and do a mailbag episode at some point. You can reach us at breakingbadgdt@gmail.com.
Yeah, so thanks for listening. Join us next week when we'll be talking about Better Call Saul. I know I'm really looking forward to this one. I know you are too, because we've been talking about it behind the scenes forever. Yeah. Cannot wait to talk about Saul. So make sure you tune into that one.
Yeah, join us next week for sure.